very much for coming. Welcome to Shakespeare and Company. And first and foremost, a big thank you to Sylvia and George Whitman and to David Delaney and everybody at Shakespeare for welcoming us. So let's give them a round of applause. Thank you, Sylvia! She's around. She's around and about. For many of you, for most of you, Cecilia Wallach doesn't need any introduction. She's a poet and a teacher, a mentor, a friend, and a sister. From Los Angeles to the Carpathian Mountains to 15 Rue Bachelet. Je pense que vous connaissez maintenant, n'est-ce pas? You know the 15 Rue Bachelet. To Istanbul, to Shepherdsville, Kentucky, with her dear family. Cecilia is really at home anywhere, all over the world, and does share her gifts so generously and passionately in her writing and in her friendship. Author of 5 books, most recently the acclaimed Carpathia. She's also recipient of an NEA, the founding director of the Paris Poetry Workshop, and Cecilia Wallach's voice is both intense and precise. In her poems, the forces of memory and longing are expertly brought under the sweet governance of craft and form, praises no other than Billy Collins, former poet laureate of the U.S. And accolades could go on.
But they won't, will they?
They won't, because at this point I will ask you to please turn off your cell phones and please give a wonderful round of applause to Cecilia Wallach.
This is Heather Hartley, for those of you who don't know. Yes, Heather Hartley.
Yeah. Woo!
Heather Hartley is my baby sister, and she's an amazing poet, and her first collection, which we waited for and waited for and waited for, and it was worth waiting for, is called Knock Knock. And if you don't have Heather's book, Knock Knock, you ought to get it. And thank you, Heather, for setting this up, for inviting us here. I am here mostly in my capacity as teacher, as a wicked poetry stepmother to 12 of the most amazing, not only 12 of the most amazing young poets, but 12 of the most amazing young human beings. They really give me great hope for the future, and I won't go on because you see I get semi-mental and I start to cry. But just to give you, well, I can't even give you an example. You're going to hear their poems tonight. I'm eager for you to hear their poems. They're really wonderful writers, and they're really, truly extraordinary human beings. So if you don't know young people, these are the young people to know. It's been so much fun to be with them. It's been such a pleasure and such a joy to be with them for the past 4 weeks. Thank you, the USC Dornsife College of Arts, Letters, and Sciences. Is that what we're called now?
Yes.
We kind of forget what we're called sometimes, but they're all students at USC. Almost all of them are graduating seniors. In the past 4 weeks, what we have done is compressed an entire semester's work into 4 weeks. And I really do feel like everyone did a semester's worth of work in 4 weeks. It's been very intense. But I'm going to start off with one poem. I'm going to read one poem of mine, and then I'm going to introduce these poets, and each of them will read for you a selection of mostly work that they've written in the past few weeks that they've been here. A lot of this stuff is very new work, and we may hear some of their more polished pieces as well. So I'm going to read a poem that tells you, you know, probably everything you know need to know about me. It explains a lot of things about me. I'm one of 7 children, and how do I say this? And I had really wonderful parents who were crazy in love with one another for a long, long time. And my mother told me once, she said, well, you know, everyone said when you were kids that we should tell you about sex, but no one told us what to tell you. So mostly they didn't tell us anything. So I figured it out all by myself. That's it. I figured it all out. Why I believed as a child that people had sex in bathrooms. Because they loved one another, I guessed. Because they had 7 kids and there wasn't a door in that house that was ever locked except for the bathroom door. That door with the devil's face, 2 horns like flame, flaring up in the grain of the wood. Or did we only imagine that shape? which meant the devil could watch you pee. The devil could see you naked, because that's where people took off their clothes and you had to undress for sex, I'd heard. Whatever sex was, lots of kissing and other stuff I wasn't sure I wanted to know. Because at night when I was scared, I just climbed into my parents' bed. Sometimes other kids were there too, and we slept in a tangle of sheets and bodies, breath, a full ashtray on the nightstand, our father's work clothes hung over a chair, our mother's damp cotton nightgown twisted around her legs. Because when I heard babies were made from sex, and sex was something that happened in bed, I thought, no, the babies are already there, in the bed. And more babies came. Because the only door that was ever locked was the bathroom door. Those two inside, in the steam of his bath, her hairsprays mist. Because sometimes I knocked and was let in, and my father lay in the tub, his whole dark body underwater like some beautiful statue I'd seen. And my mother stood in the mirror fixing her hair, or she'd put down the lid of the toilet and perch there, talking to him. Because maybe this was their refuge from us, though they never tried to keep us away. Because my mother told me once that every time they came home from the hospital with a brand new baby, they laughed and fell in love all over again and couldn't wait to start making more. Should this have confused me? It did not. Because I saw how he kissed the back of her neck and pulled her giggling into his lap. How she tucked her chin and looked up at him through her eyelashes, smiling, sly. So I reasoned whatever sex they had in the bathroom. Those steamy hours when we heard them singing to one another, then whispering, and the door stayed locked. Because I can still picture them languid there, and beautiful and young, though I had no idea how young they were. My mother soaping my father's back, her dark hair slipping out of its pins. Because what was sex after that? I didn't know he would ever die, this God in a body, strong as God, or that she would one day hang her head over the bathroom sink to weep. I was a child, only one of their children. Love was clean. Babies came from singing. The devil was wood and had no eyes. Our first poet, because we're going in alphabetical order tonight by last name, is none other than Cordelia Arterian. You can make your way to the stage. I'm not going to tell you too much about Cori because her poetry will tell you a lot about her. She's likes to rescue dogs near USC and drive them to the Pasadena Humane Society. She's a wonderful cook. Cori's the person in our group that if anything needs done, we figure Cori knows how to do it. Whether it's get a taxi in the middle of the night, make pasta, fix the printer. Seriously, I don't think there's anything that Cordelia Arterian can't do. Here's her poetry.
So I'm going to start with a little anti-bio. I was hoping everybody would read theirs because I think they're really fun. So, when Cori was in preschool, she wanted to have the neck of a pigeon because of how it shined in the light. She adopted a 7-year-old cat named Mimi this past November. She is 8 now. Often Cori will have conversations that solely revolve around her cat, which does nothing but aid the life of the nickname recently thrust upon her, Cat Cori. Her car's name is Long John Sally. It's a red 1990 Acura Integra stick shift. She and her brother drove it across country in July of 2008, despite the fact that the car has no air conditioning. She did not study creative writing, but was an English literature major. Her areas of interest are Middle Ages and very early Renaissance literature and history. Unfortunately, no one else really is interested in these topics, so her conversation fodder runs a bit low. Thus, she relies on making funny faces just so she can feel involved. For her 8th birthday, she wanted an album by the band, the 60s band Herman's Hermits, as well as a recording of Mozart's opera Don Giovanni. She can rap Kanye West offhand, but does it best when intoxicated. When she was about 6 years old, she dreamed of one day becoming the actor Nathan Lane. When and if she grows up, she'd like to be a successful comedian who makes enough money to open up an animal shelter and a bookstore, whilst also writing a spectacular memoir as well as an academic book based on how society has viewed women through the ages, and maybe she'd have a law degree too. She also plans on learning how to fly like a dodo bird. Yeah. Okay, so this is, I've changed it. It's called A Deserted Paris. I was sipping on a cure in an already dusty cafe when an armadillo walked in on his hind legs, wearing a spectacularly subtle green suit and tie, topped with a bowler hat, of all things. I couldn't see them from where I was sitting in the back corner, but I imagine he took the time to wear cufflinks to match his ridiculous beige briefcase. He was confused, naturally, as any armadillo would be in a Parisian cafe, suited up or not. Wide-eyed, he held his metro map grazing the floor in one claw and desperately clutched his briefcase in the other. Eyes still gaping, he cocked his head to the left and gazed at the sun for guidance. But alas, he was in the wrong climate. Sure, he attempted an air of belonging with his suit, tie, and hat, but the sand spilling from his briefcase wasn't fooling anyone. His mammoth, glossy eyes moved away from the sun and locked with mine, gawking. I simply shrugged a crooked smile, a sorry attempt at empathy. And with that, he rolled into a compact ball, ruining his suit, jetting over the cobblestones, artfully darting between the motorbikes, and leaving his sandy briefcase behind. Okay. This one's untitled. There's a long line for the roller coaster along my ribs. Only one passenger can be safely strapped in at a time. It's a thrilling, windy ride. Passengers disembark with hair askew, faces beaming, sunlight sneaking through the cracks of their teeth, waiting to jump out through a grin. That's the end of that one. Yeah. All right. This one's dedicated to Heather, because we did it in her workshop.
You wrote the poem in her workshop.
We didn't. Well, so this is inspired by Baudelaire's poem Get Drunk. So it's very tongue-in-cheek, I guess. Okay. Everyone should masturbate. No. Do not shy away. Love yourself before you love anyone else. It's perfect bliss. Feel the rhythms of your own body. Know the hot breath upon a pillow instead of a sweaty, glistening shoulder. Allow your tingling fingers to mingle with your beautiful body, stumbling, clamoring to the glorious immaculate space between your legs. You can take and receive without worry, because when you finish, it's all finished. No need for cuddles, snuggles, just you, heaving a last blowing breath, content with a job you know was well done. And this is a poem I actually wrote in my workshop with you 2 years ago, over 2 years ago. Okay. This is called My Blue Table. My mother was a small blue table. She sat perfectly still as her children came and went, stopping only to eat off of her belly. Her soft blouse, a tablecloth on Thanksgiving, soaking up the grease of the small piece of turkey that just slid off the plate. She welcomed messy art projects and wore those stains with pride, but she became worn down. Her bright blue finish started peeling away. I couldn't help but pick at those scabs. I just wanted to see what was underneath. So I kept picking away at her blue armor until my tiny fingers finally made progress and I got a glimpse of her past. But I could not stand to look at her broken skin, and neither could she. So I turned my small face away as she put on a coat of green to absorb the chipped blue.
In Heather's workshop. Thank you, Corey Artirian. Our next poet is Kelly Barron, who has diabolical eyebrows. Someday I'd like to be able to do what she does with her eyebrows. She comes from a long line of troublemakers. She's trained to play the piano. She was a ballerina. She runs like a baby giraffe. She's a terrible runner, but she's a beautiful poet. She's in love with Paris. Beware, she may come to live here. Here's Kelly Barron.
Hey, okay, I'm going to start with a little story. This lies somewhere between, like, flash fiction and poetry, I would say. It's called, My Mom Used to Say in Sex, There is Always Some Kind of Love. There's this boy, the girl says. I want him to touch me. Introduce yourself, her father says. You're so charming. No, 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 the mother says. Hike up your skirt. One day the girl says, Hi, I'm Audrey. He smiles politely. So she pulls up her skirt a bit and walks away. He trots up to her and says, Hungry? Very, she says. The girl doesn't get home until the next morning. There is coffee on the table. Have some, her mother says. She does. I want him to love me, the girl says. Oh, he already does, her mother says. No way, girl says. Some way, yes, mama says. The girl says, I want to hear him say it. Tell him how you feel, her father says. I don't feel anything, the girl says. I just want him to love me. You need to learn to lie better, the mother says. No, I don't agree with that, the father says. Mother looks at him and says, You are hopeless. Do you love him? The father asks. Of course not, his baby girl says. Mother turns to baby girl and says, Yes, yes, you do. I like him, the girl says. It destroys me to look at him. I would kill a hummingbird for him, she says, but I don't love him. Next time you're going down on him, the mother says, hold the base of his penis right before he comes. See where that gets you. The girl says, When she does this, the boy goes wild. After he comes, overwhelmed with pleasure, hands running through her hair, he says, Fuck. I think I love you, Audrey. This makes the girl smile. Damn, she says. The boy asks what? She climbs on top of his chest and places her center in front of his face. Let's celebrate, she says. The boy asks what? She takes off her panties and says, There's love everywhere. The boy says, My mom used to say that. Later he tells her, You taste like wine. The girl lights up. She looks at the sweet boy and thinks, God, I want to see one, catch one, crush its gorgeous little wings in my hands. Beautiful. Thank you. So, I can't remember if you mentioned this. We took a trip to Normandy recently, and I'm sure many of us will be reading. We wrote a poem based on, like, what we saw and what really stuck with us. And I'm sure many of us will be reading that. This is what I came up with. I actually saw a little film clip in the memorial, and it was these groups of women with shaved heads who were being kind of paraded on jeeps through this town, and it was filled with rubble. And I assumed they had swastikas painted on their cheeks, and I assumed that they were headed to a concentration camp. I wasn't sure. So I did a little research on it. Well, first I wrote a poem, assuming that it was, Jewish prisoners. And then I did a little research and found out that it was actually, this was taking place in a liberated French village. And these women were, they were thought to be collaborators with the enemy.
Wow.
And it was equally as disturbing to me and very reminiscent of a recent, you know, celebration about a certain very wanted man's death. So I'm going to read my revised poem. It's called The Suffering Bone. Lots of significant history there, my father said, at least for the next 50 years. People forget or come not to care. At Normandy, when you turn a certain corner, you are greeted slowly, languidly, as in a waltz, by thousands, count, thousands of graves. Rows of photogenic tombstones like stationary dominoes, except this is not a game. This is a different kind of counting. The numbers are foreign in your body. Here rests an honored glory, a comrade in arms known but to God. Can we define a comrade, a friend? Shall we shave the others' heads? My friend, Leslie, walked among the tombstones with her camera. I was surprised to find that I was always near you, she said. On the 20th of June, 1940, Etienne Achevan, an unknown civilian, decided on his own initiative to sabotage the Wehrmacht's telephone lines. There is a bone in a soldier that begins to beg, to know that his love can no longer be reserved for his lover and family, that his circle of trust must expand, warmly so, even under war-tethered tyranny. A new family, a love so awful that the chest must be clutched by the hand. My heart is beating, Etienne perhaps said. I can feel my heart beating. He was shot on the 4th of July, 1940, near Rouen. When the shaved-head women, possible collaborators with swastikas painted below their cheekbones, are paraded on jeeps through a liberated French village, cluttered with rubble, I took some pictures, Leslie said, and a woman, a stout matriarch, is rifle butt slapped. We are free, like a tetherball on spread flat palms, and she bares her teeth, sick, nothing to vomit. Does the bone not wail? A handsome young man follows the jeep down fallen streets along with the crowd. Yes, a crowd. He catches the camera's eye and whips his girlfriend around to face it. His girlfriend, whose blonde curls slap her apple cream cheeks. I took some pictures of you, Leslie said. Tiens, the boy maybe says, souriez. And she is beautiful, she with her hair. Rows of graves like synchronized swimmers, with no surface to ripple. People forget or come not to care. I was surprised to find that I was always near you, Leslie said. Here, I will wager a guess, that the bone of suffering dwells within our chests, each of us, to keep us from shaking the stiff hand of a just hanged man. I took some pictures of you, she said, so you'd at least know you were here. Am I 5 minutes?
I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to read a little short one to lighten the mood before the next one comes. It's an ode to a favorite shell of mine, a pink conch shell. Thank Christ for you, you little gem. I was drowning at the swap meet, and you, creature of the South African waters, you saved me. I was so lost and hot in that crowd. So sad, so silly over the sudden loss of familiar love. And there I was, so sad and sweaty, and you caught my eye, and that was it. I am saved. Now you sit on my nightstand, regal and sexual, and we live and read and sleep together. Your pink insides bloom outwards like the rim of a trumpet. Your hot bubblegum insides. Every time I look at you, I think, if I were a man, I'd want to fuck that thing. The fig effect. So gorgeous with your whiteness, your pink, freckled whiteness. How can you exist? How lucky I am. Of all the awful swap meets, in all the towns, in all the world, you wash up at mine. I love you and your thorny delicacy and your salt-scented stomach. I love you, I love you, I love you. Thank you, guys.
That shell feels the same way about you.
I think so too.
You know, you thorny and delicate thing. So, our next poet is Matthew Cruz. As I've said, this is an extraordinary group of human beings, and I can't tell you everything about them, but I can tell you a few things about them. Matthew is one of the most enlightened feminists I've ever met, and in addition to being a wonderful poet and performer, he performed at the Cabaret Populaire, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Quite amazingly. He's also a playwright. So, here's Matthew Cruz. Yeah.
Thank you. This is a poem. We were assigned to write something to do with dreams at one point. I don't remember when that was.
Sometime in the past. Yeah, there was, yes. Weeks, there
was so this is titled, A Poem Upon Waking from a Dream About the Bible. This is the end for you, God. No more gutless lying for your sins and for our salvation. I am done. Gone Buddhist, gone to roll your precious holy pages into blunts and gone to breathe them into ash. Gone to fuck with marriages and leather-strapped fags who want a stranger's filthy sex leather-strapped to their filthy sex. Smacking women around isn't enough for your men. You men, you want to dominate women or force them, push them down sideways onto a marital bed where in a blind second they think, oh, he's finally being a man. Wait, he's not finally being a man. Stop, he is not being a man. Please, he is being a rapist, clinging to his lost human credentials, wearing a hand-lettered side reading, hello, my name is I rape someone, and I'm not allowed to have friends or family or freedom or love anymore. This is actually a dramatic monologue. It was based on a free write that we did with Ellen Hinsey, and which Ellen Hinsey, thank you so much. You're absolutely incredible. I think I speak for most of the class when I say that.
Everyone.
Speak for the world.
I speak for the world when I say that. This is working title, based on 100,000 true stories. I am scared to tell you what happened to me because I know if I start, then I'll never stop. Never stop crying, never stop cold blood screaming and tearing pieces of skin off my face at night and in the shower because of what this disease has done to me. Don't call it a disease, they've said, because it gives it a kind of stigma. Yes, a stigma. A bone-showing stomach acid in my mouth eating at my teeth stigma. The kind that keeps me in the bathroom for hours, in the mirror forever, because why? Because it's how you survive. It's how you survive trauma, being blindsided on some random Tuesday by a boyfriend who doesn't understand or hear or care about the word no, or a ballet teacher who says something she thinks is offhand about your stomach, but is really on hand, like a tapeworm sucking at your soul. It is how you cope with people commenting on how great you look now that you've lost your baby fat after that flu, or went on that diet your mom's been hinting at since you were 10. It is how you react to American Apparel's largest size being an 8 when the average American woman is closer to a 14. 77 pounds and a shit weak snail crawling heart rate and my fucking pretty now? Am I in control yet? Do I believe I'm worthy to take up space? People ask me a lot of questions. Someone even said, what should I have said to you to stop this from getting so bad? Fuck you. Don't say anything. Listen. Listen when I say I was raped, torn inside out from the outside and into places human kindness can't see. Listen and don't ask me what I was wearing when it happened. Listen and know you can't save me with words, but with presence. Listen because my body is fading and I'll never get the chance to tell my family I'm sorry for being hard to look at before and after and maybe I'll do better when I'm gone and just the thought of a woman, of a person. Please tell me I'll be healthy again. You'll be healthy again. Please tell me I'll be happy again. You'll be happy again. I watch you. I will watch you breathe for me. I will watch you eat for me. I will watch you smile for me. I will watch you live for me. Please, I am only one. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew, Chris, very, very much. Wish I could clone these people. I clone them. Especially Leslie Wasserman. especially Corinne DeWitt. I'm going to tell you a few things about her. I'm stealing some... Christelle? One of the things we did in the past 4 weeks was we took a whirlwind trip to Normandy, immersed ourselves in the history of Normandy after having spent some time working with Ellen Hinsey and talking about poetry and civil rights, poetry and human rights. And Christelle from ISA, from International Studies Abroad, escorted us in the big, beautiful, sleepy bus.
And then we fell in love with her.
And we fell in love with her. So we're all in love with Christelle. And in fact, everything that we're reading from here on in is actually a love poem to Christelle. So here it comes. So our next poet is Corinne DeWitt. Corinne was 5'3" in the second grade. She was taller than the teacher, so the other kids would ask her for permission to go to the bathroom. So Corinne started to drink coffee, black espresso, when she was 10 to try to stunt her growth. And I don't think I'm the only one who's glad that it didn't work. Okay? She is statuesque, beautiful, hardworking. She's a visual artist as well as a poet. She sometimes carries hot sauce in her purse. She has built a house from foundation to roof. She once ate the head of a baby cow. And some people are afraid of her. Here's Corinne DeWitt.
Hi. Okay. Thanks for those facts that you picked up.
Okay. Just put some on my table.
Okay. This is called Sunday Morning on Rue Voltaire. I catch his eye near the boulangerie. My face full of fromage, I turn away. His weathered visage lingers hauntingly, looming heavy in my brain. His voice like sticky, chewed caramel strings, a soft bonjour, monsieur, to each passerby. Monsieurs who brusquely barrel over him, flicking their cigarettes in crude reply. Hot ash peppers his eyes and owl brow, accordion crease like his paper cup. He brushes clean his face and sooty shawl, waits for Madame to pass, then looks back up. There is yeast in the air, cruel snaking scent, baguette steam from the boulangerie vent. All right, this one was rough for me to write. It was inspired by Ellen Hinsey's lecture for us and the social issues that we were asked to delve into, which was an area that was untouched for me but until now, so here's my attempt at discussing something more important. It's called New Orleans, 2005. Bourbon Street jazz swells, sweet sinuous beats bump through our bodies and burrow under our skin, glistening wet, salt sweat, and the saxophone sings higher, drowning in ringing the dig of the bass. The majestic oak bass throbs with deep memory swells, and teary notes higher than the barge once beat, cymbal crash beat, hit the rocks of the levee until they gave way to the wet, river stone surge rough through its body. We felt the wave in our bodies, thumping hearts pumped like bass, churning the city with wet, poison swells, water beats higher than rooftops. We must go somewhere higher, must outrun the water, its beating, breaking our bodies. Cicadas chitting in trees, the tambourine to waves bass. Cracked tree trunks, oaks succumb to the swell, seltzer fizz hiss steeping into the wet. Our city is wet, rusted tin crags in water, it's higher than houses, than heads, swollen like vomit up in our throats, beating, stirring from the gut of the Mississippi's base, gurgling up in the mouths of swirling limp bodies. Who will remember these people, unrecognizable bodies, now that the wave has given way to wet, mold and corpse-covered city, the bass thumping higher than the pulsating beat of the receding swells. Now somewhere on Bourbon, the bass sings the song of the bodies that could not get higher than the storm's deadly wet. We will not forget. Blood still swells to the hurricane beat.
And what Corinne didn't tell you, and maybe you didn't even notice, is that that's a sestina.
tape?
It's a perfectly made sestina. And you have to be crazy to write a sestina. Maybe I could write one if I were only taller. But I've never succeeded, so my hat is off to you. Beautiful, gorgeous poem. Our next poet is Jessica Eller. Jessica is really, really good at spending money, putting crucial assignments off till the last minute, and watching videos on YouTube. She says she has a terrible sense of direction, a cruel sense of humor, and an unhealthy obsession with blogs about nutrition. She can deadlift more than most guys at her gym. She can pack a suitcase better than anyone you know. Mm-hmm. She really enjoys doing math. She likes her coffee black, her eggs poached, and her liquor straight up. Here's Jessica Eller.
I will do my best to read slowly, but I get very nervous. This first one, I'll start with the tough one. It was also based on our trip to Normandy, some things I saw there, as well as some family history that I learned about recently. It's called Lebensraum, and that is German for living space for the Aryan race. Gabriella had two sisters. When she was 15 years old, they were 1 and 3. When she was 16, they were dead. One man decided to be in charge of the world, and millions of cowards cowered to him. You know you're doing the right thing, slaughtering towns full of strangers, numb to the desperate shrieking and the death stench. Doing the right thing, throwing live infants up toward the open sky, to shoot them down like targets, to blow their breath away, before they thud back down to earth. Throwing live infants up toward the open sky because they're so small that it's hard to get them to stay just so still. It's easier to pinpoint their little bodies with your bullets when they're in free fall. They're so small, but if you weren't numb to the desperate shrieking and the death stench, it would be you standing by powerless as your baby's skulls are pierced by lead. Gabriella had two sisters. It's kill or be killed, they keep telling you. When she was 15 years old, they were 1 and 3, and you want to live. When she was 16, they were dead. And your leader has been having wet dreams about you and your millions of blonde-haired, blue-eyed offspring. Gabriella had two sisters. He's making space for your future family like a little boy throwing away his old toys the night before Christmas, certain that he's about to get something better. When she was 15 years old, they were 1 and 3. He wants you to live too. When she was 16, they were dead. My grandmother's sisters, then 2 and 4 years old, spent 20 minutes locked inside a windowless cell, inhaling cyanide, their skin turning shades of red and green, and peeling off their slight skeletons before their bodies gave in. Gabriella had two sisters. Pick up the tone for a minute. This next one's called D, and it's sort of a blazon. With his steel-toed leather hair, with his teeth of mismatched socks, with his cheeks pages of Braille, full of souvenirs from his scarred and storied past, with his slickly sandpaper palms, forcefully sumptuous creme caramel hands, arms of stone coated in butter and silk, with his infinite shoulders, a neck of burnt sugar, the voice of a beat-up bike motoring over gravel in the gray of dusk. He's a bruised peach, an asymmetrical garment on the final sale rack, expired milk, a return puzzle, box left open, pieces missing, for which I gladly pay full price every time. And this was sort of a social issues piece as well, just inspired by a news article that I read recently. In other news, members of the U.S. military are dying, a known job hazard in that line of work. But someone has been keeping a real close body count, and for the second year in a row, the rate of deaths by suicide exceeded the rate of deaths due to combat. So let's snazz that first sentence up a bit. Members of the U.S. military are committing suicide at alarming rates, and I quote, alarming that more random faceless uniforms with guns are turning said guns on themselves, as opposed to the enemy, of course. Alarming that not enough men are dying in combat, and if more men were, the number of suicides could stay the same, yet be statistically irrelevant. Alarming that this is some sort of sign of job dissatisfaction, and how are we going to continue to recruit when the current employees clearly aren't happy with management? Alarming that the fresh-faced 18-year-old high school graduate who enlists so that he can afford to go to college, to make his parents proud, to serve and protect his country as he believes is his duty, to make a living, to make himself a man, is hit hard by the real world and mortality and consequences in humanity and life decisions and squalid living conditions, and at some point he has had enough? Or alarming that the mass media accounts of this information read like the nutrition label on a box of cereal, all numbers and nitpicky statistical comparisons. Well, if you account for accidents and deaths due to illness, and we all know that those deaths don't count, there are no parents or girlfriends or husbands or children who will cry when they receive the news of those deaths, then this number is slightly higher than that number this year, and actually, let's call it significantly higher, because that just packs more punch. To sum it all up, and again I quote, the reasons are complicated and the accounting uncertain. For instance, should returning soldiers who take their own lives after being mustered out be included?
Thank you, Jessica. Our next poet is Sophia Kang, also known as Sophie Kang. She doesn't mind whether you call her Sophia or Sophie. She is younger than she looks, she tells us. She knows how to cross-stitch and embroider. She has never had braces or a nosebleed. Water is her beverage of choice. She is a terrible winker. She's been to Tanzania and Switzerland, but she doesn't want to talk about it. She always has room for dessert. She doesn't know what she's going to do with her English degree. Sophia Kang.
So, since we're at Shakespeare and Company, I thought I'd start with a sonnet called For Shakespeare. I must write a sonnet. It's my homework. Sonnet. Three quatrains, one couplet, strong closure. Sounds simple enough, but oh, how I'm irked. It demands iambic pentameter. Jump. Less stress, stress. Da-da-da-da-da-da. 10 syllables per line, the min and max, no ifs, ands, or buts. Last straw. Am I there yet? Never mind the syntax. It has to rhyme. These lines. Quick. What rhymes with? So many rules to keep track. Wait a sec. Hold on. I'm counting syllables with my breath. Right now, I hate Shakespeare more than my ex. I'm almost done. I'll be Bonnie and Blythe. Shakespeare, my nemesis. Satisfied? And as much as I dislike Shakespeare, we had to write about a moment in Paris, and so I've adopted his form again. It's called Monday Afternoon at Parc des Bouchamont. At Parc des Bouchamont, my friends and I collapsed on a steep hill, too tired to take one more step. Forget picturesque. We couldn't find Père Lachaise. Cigs are lit. Inhaled, exhaled, not far from families, couples, and frolicking children. No sunbathers here like in Los Angeles. Kids run peekabooing neath the trees. A shirtless man saunters over for a light and lies in the shade, clearly within our view, and staring at the sky. Half a bottle of wine later, champagne bubbles over. It's a celebration. Welcome to Paris, a pair of men shout from the top. A lucky accident leads to a lovely afternoon.
Nice.
This one, we asked to write a translation poem, so we wrote a poem in English, translated to French, and then back to English, so I need to credit Google Translate for helping me with this one. It's a poem about the apartment that I'm living in Paris right now. Sunny yellow walls and pails, pastel fishing. A rough table against the wall. A vase of pink roses kissed the invisible man on the shelf. So that delicate leaves of gold dance and glance at the ceiling. I swim in a rainbow of joy through ragtag pale stools. Pillows are swept into a sea of jazz. I'm in a trance, but a girl knows this home. And to end, I'm bringing it back to Baudelaire and using his Get Drunk poem, but this is very different in content. It's called Patience. One should always be patient. Think not of what needs to be done or should have been finished already long ago yesterday, because there will always be time. Patience? Patience for what? For babies, elderly ladies, your parents, and yourself. Be patient. Be patient because the best things always comes to those who wait, if not now, in the hereafter. Like the first auburn of autumn leaves, pasta made from scratch with homemade marinara, or a letter in the mail. And love, true love, after overcoming the obstacles, the fights, and the words. Wouldn't you say it was all worth it? So please, please, my dear, be patient, for we only have these endless number of days.
Beautiful. That is Sophia Kang.